This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton. The United States said Monday it remained ready to meet with Iran after Tehran rejected an EU-proposed meeting. State Department spokesman Ned Price told reporters Monday that the United States is not dogmatic about the form and format of those talks. President Joe Biden's administration supports a return to the 2015 nuclear accord, from which former President Donald Trump withdrew in 2018. Last month, the Biden administration said it was willing to meet with Iran in a meeting proposed by the European Union. The meeting would involve other signatories of the 2015 agreement, Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia. Iran said Sunday that the timing was not suitable, as it remained insistent that the United States first lift sanctions imposed by the Trump administration after the United States withdrew from the agreement. While Price said the United States is not set on a particular format for the talks, he said it is set on one thing, in his words, quote, that Iran cannot be allowed to acquire a nuclear weapon. Iran has insisted that sanctions imposed by Mr. Trump, including a sweeping ban on its oil exports, should be removed before it reverses steps out of nuclear compliance that it took as protest measures. The World Health Organization said Monday new coronavirus cases increased globally for the first time in 7 weeks. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said Monday that the increases occurred in 4 regions, the Americas, the Eastern Mediterranean, Europe, and Southeast Asia. He said the rise was disappointing but not surprising and appeared to be the result of relaxing public health measures and people letting down their guard due to recent vaccination programs. You're listening to VOA News. The United States on Monday urged Saudi Arabia to disband an elite unit controlled by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman that Washington sanctioned over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. President Joe Biden on Friday declassified an intelligence report that found that Prince Mohammed ordered the 2018 killing of Khashoggi, a U.S.-based contributor to the Washington Post, who was lured into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The report found that 7 of the 15 members of the hit squad that flew to Istanbul came from the Rapid Intelligence Force, which it said exists to defend the Crown Prince and answers only to him. The Treasury Department imposed sanctions on the force, meaning any U.S. transactions with it will be a crime, but the administration stopped short of personally targeting the Crown Prince. On Monday, State Department spokesman Ned Price vowed that the Biden administration would put a higher priority on human rights following former President Donald Trump's chummy relationship with the Saudis. He told reporters, quote, "We have made crystal clear and will continue to do so that the brutal killing of Jamal Khashoggi 28 months ago remains unacceptable conduct." But he said the United States would maintain its longstanding alliance with the oil-producing kingdom. Two United Nations human rights experts have called for the immediate release of imprisoned Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. They've also called for an international probe into his poisoning last year. The two experts, Agnes Callamard and Irene Kahn, said in a statement Monday that Navalny's poisoning was an act meant to send a clear, sinister warning that this would be the fate of anyone who would criticize and oppose the government. Calamard is the UN Special Rapporteur dealing with extrajudicial executions, and Khan is a Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Expression. On Monday, they released the text of the official letter that they sent to Russian authorities in December. And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres expressed disappointment Monday that a donors conference for Yemen received less than half of the nearly $4 billion needed to prevent a catastrophic famine from potentially killing millions of people in the war-torn country. Millions of Yemeni children, women, and men desperately need aid to live, Guterres said in a statement. Cutting aid is a death sentence. The $1.67 billion in pledges committed at the virtual pledging conference Monday falls far short of the $3.85 billion the UN says is needed this year overall. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Amnesty International says war crimes are being committed in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province.
The situation in Cabo Delgado is extremely serious, and it's getting worse almost day by day. All sides are committing war crimes, and all sides are committing different kinds of war crimes based upon their intentions.
Zanzibar names a new first vice president. Zimbabwe's second vice president resigns. An upcoming book on Bring Back Our Girls movement and activism in Nigeria. Malawi's president announces measures to help build out the country's economy from COVID-19 shocks. And Kenya expects to receive its first consignment of COVID-19 vaccine today, Tuesday.
We expect to receive the first consignment of COVID vaccines, AstraZeneca, to be specific, 1,020,000 doses, should be arriving here on Tuesday night.
A former French president, Sarkozy, is convicted of corruption. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Amnesty International says hundreds of civilians have been killed in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province by an armed group known locally as Al-Shabaab, the government security forces, and a private company hired by the government. The claims are contained in a new report released yesterday entitled, What I Saw is Death, War Crimes in Mozambique's Forgotten Cape. Brian Kastner is the senior crisis advisor for Amnesty International and one of the authors of the report.
The situation in Cabo Delgado is extremely serious, and it's getting worse almost day by day.
Brian, so basically your report describes three groups in that theater of conflict: the Mozambique security forces, the private militia, who you said are fighting alongside the government, and the armed opposition known as Al-Shabaab. It seems your report is suggesting that all sides are responsible for the violence.
It is definitely true that all sides are committing war crimes, and all sides are committing different kinds of war crimes based upon their intentions. It's not our aim to lay more or less blame on any one group. What we do try to do is explain why we think the fighting is happening, and that's longstanding grievances, local people with longstanding frustrations about their political, economic, social, and cultural rights, poverty over generations, long-term underinvestment, lack of education, access to electricity.
When you talk about Al-Shabaab, sometimes we read about jihadists or Muslim extremists. What is the difference here? Are there Muslim extremists in Mozambique, or the relationship to this Al-Shabaab?
That's a good question. So the armed group, we call them Al-Shabaab because that's what the local people in Cabo Delgado call them. They call themselves other names. One of those is that in 2019, they did pledge an oath to the Islamic State. And so they are technically part of the Islamic State Central African province. However, I do want to stress, in our research, these are not outsiders that have come to Mozambique. These are locals that speak local languages. They are well known to the communities in which they are fighting. We had some people that we interviewed say it was very confusing because they recognized the fighters and they weren't sure who was fighting whom.
Why do you think Cabo Delgado has become this fertile ground for the conflict?
Yes, Cabo Delgado is often called Mozambique's Forgotten Cape because there have been so many years of the central government. Unfortunately, there is this resource curse that we see in other parts of the world where there are gemstones, rubies in particular, in Cabo Delgado. Liquid natural gas was discovered in 2010. There are outside international oil companies, energy companies, that are setting up extraction industries in Cabo Delgado. And the local people have seen outside companies come in and extract the wealth without getting any benefit for themselves. Combine that with a lack of education and a lack of other services, and it's really an obvious breeding ground for an insurgency.
Did Amnesty travel to Cabo Delgado, or how did you go about researching this report?
That's a very good question. So because of COVID, I myself did not travel to Cabo Delgado, and we did not send other researchers there. We conducted all of this research remotely using secure communications all of the 79 people, internally displaced people that we spoke to. We have kept their names anonymous for their own security reasons, because there's a history of reprisals from the Mozambican government, from people that talk about the problems in Cabo Delgado. But what we also did was conduct what we call an open source investigation. We looked at videos from the region, photos from the region. We have photos and videos of Dyke Advisory Group's operations, of torture and executions by the Mozambican security forces. And then, very importantly, we did a lot of satellite imagery research. Where we were able to map the homes that were burned to the ground in these villages and towns. And that really confirmed, you know, the testimony research we got from talking to the displaced persons.
Brian, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, and thank you for
your interest in the report. Brian Kastner is a senior crisis advisor for Amnesty International and one of the authors of a new report on the crisis in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province. He was speaking with us from New York. Zanzibar's President Hussein Ali Mwinyi on Monday named Othman Masoud Othman as the semi-autonomous island's first vice president. Othman replaces Malim Seif Sharif Hamman of the opposition ACT Wazalendo party, who passed away February 17 this year. The late Hamman was appointed by President Mwinyi of the ruling Chamacha Mapinduzi CCM party after his party agreed to be part of a national unity government. Ismail Jossa is a member of the ACT Wazalendo party central committee.
Mr. Othman Masoud is a former Attorney General of Zanzibar who has earned high respect in the islands because of his strength Zanzibar interest. He has served previously in many posts in Zanzibar, including Director of Public Prosecutions. And before that, he was Deputy Attorney General and also Permanent Secretary in the Ministry of Constitutional Legal Affairs. And as a person, he's somebody who is highly knowledgeable, a teammate who likes to work in a team, is a consensus builder, a unifier, somebody who is very well versed with knowledge about Zanzibar history, politics, and administration. So I believe he will be the best person to fill in the position that has been left by the late Malim Seif Sharif Hamad.
So he is a member of ACT Wazalendo party.
Yeah, he joined recently. He was always not a party member of any political party, but used to work with us closely. During the life of the late Malim Seif Sharif Hamad, he will be given different tasks to do on behalf of us, and we will always do that. He was also a member of the committee that drafted the party manifesto in the last elections.
What kind of message do you think your president, President Mwinyi, what message is he sending in terms of bringing Zanzibar together in terms of national unity?
Well, first of all, he has sent a very strong message, and we are very thankful and grateful to the president for honoring the choice that the party had sent to him to take over the position that was held on by Malim Seif Sharif Hamad. Secondly, I think Mr. Othman Masoud, given his vast knowledge in terms of the administration, the legal affairs of Zanzibar, history and governance issues, and he's somebody who is very visionary, very much in line with the vision that President Hussein Mwinyi himself has for the future of Zanzibar. I think the two of them will work together very well to serve the best interests of Zanzibar and her people.
Mr. Masoud is replacing your late Vice President Seif Sharif Hamad, who passed away earlier this month. How are the people of Zanzibar dealing with this loss?
Well, people are still mourning, and I think given the towering figure that Malim Seif was, Malim Seif Sharif Hamad was part of Zanzibar politics and maybe the main iconic figure of Zanzibar political life for the past 40 years. So it's not that easy for people to forget him. He was a towering figure. So Zanzibaris still talk about him, still mourn about his loss, and I think it will take a very long time. But we are all, and also the people of Zanzibar, all prepared for a new kind of political life without Malim Seif Sharif Hamad. And that is why today we are also very happy to hear the news of the appointment of Honorable Othman Masoud Othman to replace him as the next first vice president.
Thank you so much again. So nice to talk with you.
Thanks a lot, James.
Ishmael Jossa is a member of the ACT Wazalendo Central Committee. You are speaking with us from Zanzibar City.
Zimbabwe's second vice president, Campbell Mohadi, resigned on Monday following reports in local media that he had been involved in sexual impropriety. In a statement, the 70-year-old Mohadi said he was resigning not as a matter of cowardice, but as a sign of demonstrating great respect to the office of the president so that it is not compromised by actions linked to his challenges as an individual. Paul Mangwana is a senior member of Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party.
It is true, yeah.
Did he say why he resigned?
Because of the recent videos released on immorality.
What does that mean?
These videos were taken on his conversation with girlfriends.
Was he married?
No, he's divorced.
Did the government accept the resignation?
Yes, they have.
What is the process now? What's next?
Well, I think it's him just going to leave office, and then we are waiting to hear the final decision on how his post is going to be filled.
I'm wondering, was he asked by President Mnangagwa to resign, or he resigned on his own?
He resigned on his own.
If this is a video about a girlfriend, he's not married, why does he feel the need to resign?
Yeah, well, it was not one, just one girlfriend. The other girlfriend was a married woman.
Oh, so this is more serious than just a girlfriend.
Yeah.
Was the other girlfriend married to an official or just married to somebody else?
Married to an official.
Is he likely to be prosecuted or what?
Well, that process there is something else. I don't know whether he's going to be prosecuted or not. But there's been that call for him to resign. Many people were saying, no, he should do the honorable thing to resign, which is what he did.
We understand his resignation was posted by the Ministry of Information.
Yeah, it was one of the news, one of the main news at 8 o'clock today.
Thank you so much for clarifying.
You're welcome.
That was Paul Mangwana, a senior member of Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 2nd. Kenya expects to receive its first batch of COVID-19 vaccine under the COVAX facility today, Tuesday. The country's health ministry says slightly over a million doses of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine is expected and that health workers will be given first priority, followed by other frontline workers, including teachers and security personnel. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, there are mixed reactions by Kenyans about the vaccine.
The health ministry has confirmed that Kenya will receive 1.02 million doses of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine as part of the first batch of the 4.1 million doses. It says Kenya plans to eventually import 24 million doses. The chairperson of the COVID-19 Task Force for Vaccine Deployment and the Vaccination Process, Dr. Willis Akwale, says the first priority will be given to health workers and everyone else who works in a health facility, including cooks and clerks, followed by security forces and teachers.
We expect to receive the first consignment of COVID vaccines, AstraZeneca, to be specific, 1,020,000 doses, should be arriving here on Tuesday night. The priority is frontline health workers, all health workers, the professional health workers, and anybody who works within the health facility, whether they are clerks, whether they are cooks. Our security forces as well have also been prioritized. And then we go to the teachers and instructors of education colleges.
Dr. Akwale further describes how the government intends to roll out the vaccine.
The plan is that immediately we receive this at the airport, they will be delivered to the central vaccine store, which is in Kitengela. We will start immediate distribution to 9 of the regional vaccine stores that cover a number of counties. And we expect that within 2 to 3 days, the vaccines will have been distributed to all these regional vaccine stores, and the counties can then start accessing them.
World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom is calling for vaccine equity, saying it is the only way to beat the virus globally.
We can't beat COVID without vaccine equity. Our world will not recover fast enough without vaccine equity. This is clear. So sharing the vaccine which is being produced is actually the best way to bring lives and livelihoods back to normal.
Meanwhile, Kenyans are expressing mixed reactions about the vaccine, with some lauding it while others are bashing it. The government, however, says the vaccine is optional and no one will be forced to take it. Antonina Atieno, an ICU nurse at Kenyatta National Hospital, the biggest referral hospital in the country, says she does not have confidence in the vaccine and might only take it once it has been tried and tested on others.
My feeling toward the COVID-19 vaccine is fear. I think I actually fear the vaccine more than I fear the disease itself. I don't think I'm ready to take the vaccine now. Probably I'll consider taking it, but a bit later, after the first lot of people have taken it and a trial has been done and we've seen the outcome.
Phase 2 of the COVID-19 vaccination process will begin in July 2021 to June 2022, targeting 9.7 million Kenyans, mostly persons above 50 years of age and those with underlying health conditions. The health ministry, however, says that the arrival of the COVID-19 vaccine does not mean that Kenyans should drop their guard. Instead, it is urging Kenyans to continue observing the containment measures. Kenya's COVID-19 caseload now stands at 106,125, with 1,859 fatalities. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Malawi's president, Lazarus Chakwera, has announced measures to help build out the country's economy from COVID-19 shocks. In a televised national address over the weekend, Chakwera announced cash transfers for the vulnerable and ordered an extension of loan repayments. But as Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, critics say the measures are too small and selective to bring Malawi's struggling economy back on track.
In his hour-long address, President Chakwera said he was concerned with Malawi's economic low growth rate for 2020, which he said was at 0.9%. He said the slump in the growth rate was largely because of unforeseen expenditures towards managing the COVID-19 pandemic, including $21 million to deal with the second wave of cases and the need to cancel the rescheduled final exams for secondary school students.
The unforeseen expenditures for readministering the Malawi School Certificate of Education examinations have contributed to an overexpenditure of 2.5% above the 974.6 billion kwacha targeted for the first 6 months.
At the same, Chakwera said government revenue is down because of the pandemic.
As announced by my Minister of Finance in his media budget review statement before Parliament 2 days ago, 600.1 billion kwacha was projected to be collected during the first half of the current financial year. Yet what we collected fell short of that target by 6%.
Despite the shortfall, Chakwera said his administration has instituted various measures to ease economic shocks on the most vulnerable. These include cash transfers to the poor and an extension of loan repayments for business people.
2 days ago, the first cash payments covering January and February were made to 24,383 households in Blantyre, 21,101 households in Lilongwe, 8,695 households in Mzuzu, and 9,445 households in Zomba.
He said this represents nearly a third of 200,000 households that are eligible for assistance under the program during this first quarter of 2021. However, Vincent Konrowe, a former lecturer on governance at Catholic University in Malawi, says the administration could have considered measures that would put food on people's tables.
And when I talk about food, I'm talking about meals. So maybe if the government could have distributed some free meals to some particularly heavily affected households, and especially if they could have been able to identify those people who live from hand to mouth and the elderly.
The Minister of Agriculture authorities say the government is addressing that by subsidizing the price of maize so that people can buy it at an affordable price. Overall, Malawi has recorded nearly 32,000 cases of COVID-19 and 1,044 deaths. That includes 150 new cases and 3 deaths reported Sunday. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
This week, a new book will be released in the United States that explores the accountability of what happened in 2014 when millions of Twitter users tweeted, "Bring back our girls," about the kidnapping of 276 schoolgirls by Boko Haram in Nigeria. Co-authors Joel Parkinson and Drew Henshaw dive deeply into the aftermath of the Twitter storm and the repercussions of viral activism. Henshaw spoke with Ricky Stryak about the questions and answers within the book.
People didn't realize that their tweets inspired several foreign militaries to send drones, special forces, spies to West Africa. Mercenaries went to Nigeria looking for these young women. And there was never follow-up to say, well, what did those guys end up doing? What did those drones end up doing? What did those mercenaries end up doing? There were intelligence officers at the CIA station in Abuja looking for these young women. Well, what exactly was going on in there? And why couldn't this collection of very powerful militaries find a group of hundreds of teenagers?
The kidnapping of these girls in Chibok, unfortunately, is not a rarity in northern Nigeria, especially, I mean, even in the last few months, there have been multiple kidnappings of schoolboys. Does the book explore how social media not only impacted this one event, but like why it's not maybe impacting the other events?
I mean, there's this phenomenon called the identifiable victim effect, where like one victim becomes a way to tell a larger tragedy. Like we learn about like Anne Frank to learn about the Holocaust. And that's what happened here with these young women. I mean, they were, you know, there were thousands and thousands of victims of Boko Haram at that point. But these young women, because the details of what happened to them were so evocative, they sort of captured the imagination both in Nigeria and abroad. On the one hand, I think a lot of Nigerians, like Dr. Obi Ezekwesili, felt like we need to draw the line, we need to bring these young women home, at some point we need to act. Whereas at the same time, I think in the West maybe, the Chibok girls became more important than Boko Haram.
Are there dangers in maybe oversimplifying an ongoing conflict with an insurgency such as Boko Haram?
It's such a complicated conflict. It's extremely complicated. It's been going on for years, and somehow through the simplicity of Twitter and the simplicity of like the narrative that was told in abroad, it became this simple good versus evil conflict, which you can completely understand. You know, it is evil to take hundreds of young women from the dormitory where they're sleeping, you know? At some point, somebody needed to do the work of understanding Boko Haram and understanding why were they doing this? Why were they kidnapping young people? It's a group that's much easier to condemn than understand. One thing that was interesting to us, we wrote a lot about how the Swiss got involved, and this group of Swiss and Nigerian volunteers essentially did the hard work of, you know, asking themselves, what does Boko Haram want? How can we talk to them? How can we address them? How can we meet them and dialogue with them and try to, you know, reason with them and convince them?
What kind of impact do you hope the book has?
Most importantly, 23,000 and I think 92 Nigerians are missing after this conflict. It's the highest number of missing people that the Red Cross has registered in any country in the world. So we want to keep attention on the fact that there are tens of thousands of people missing. The second point we thought is when this hashtag started, there were people saying this is wonderful, it's positive, it's going to lead to a good outcome. And there were people saying, oh, this is just slacktivism, it's not going to make any difference in the real world. We found like the truth is so much stranger. Our tweets had years and years of consequences, many of them good, but many of them sort of made things kind of stranger and more complicated and chaotic. And we wanted readers in Nigeria and abroad to like grapple with the fact that when you tweet something like this, you are having an effect.
That was Drew Henshaw, co-author of Bring Back Our Girls, the untold story of the global search for Nigeria's missing school girls. You are speaking to Ricky Stryak from Warsaw. And that's it for this Tuesday, March 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a good day.
Yeah. Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.